Shout out your joy in Yahweh, all you people. We've been thinking on Sunday mornings about God's personal name, and there it is, the name Yahweh, or Jehovah. The traditional way of saying it in English is Jehovah. Guide me, O thou great Jehovah. Before Jehovah's awful throne, ye nations bow with sacred joy. Most scholars nowadays think it's more accurate to say Yahweh, and that's the form we've used in that psalm we've just sung. But it doesn't really matter. The important thing is not how it's pronounced, Yahweh, Jehovah. The important thing is what it means. The name means He is, or perhaps I am. Every time the Bible calls God Yahweh or Jehovah, it's a reminder that God is. He simply is. He is who He is. He never changes. He's always the same. And that's why He can be trusted. His character doesn't change. His plans don't change. His promises don't change. If He enters a relationship with you, that relationship will go on forever. Whatever is true of Him now always will be true. He simply is. That name, God's name, Yahweh, is used thousands of times in the Bible. But as I've pointed out to you, it's usually hidden in our English Bibles. Usually when you've got that name in the Hebrew, the English translators have used instead the phrase the Lord, with the word Lord in capital letters. So you've got to keep your eyes open when you're reading the AV or the NIV or the ESV. Watch out and see how often you find the word Lord written in capital letters. And whenever you do, it means that what you've got there in the original is God's personal name, Yahweh or Jehovah, the one who is. And you'll find that actually it's used thousands upon thousands of times. Now, I said a fortnight ago that we would be looking at some of the times when God's name, Jehovah or Yahweh, is linked with another word. It happens, you remember, in Genesis 22. Abraham said to his son Isaac, Yahweh will provide Himself a lamb for the burnt offering. And Yahweh did. And Abraham called that place Yahweh Yireh. Jehovah Jireh. It means Yahweh will provide. Yahweh, the unchanging God, the God who simply is, will always provide everything that's needed for the plan of salvation to be completed. He can be trusted to provide. That's built into the name, Yahweh Yireh. It happened again in Exodus 15. The Israelites, travelling through the wilderness, came to a place called Marah, where the water was bitter, it was undrinkable. And there in that plague spot, they began to experience thirst. And they began to panic and to protest and to blame Moses. What are we going to drink? But Yahweh intervened. He rescued them. He transformed the bitter water. He made it sweet and wholesome for them. And then He declared, I am Yahweh who heals you. Yahweh Rophakah. So whenever you come into situations which could hurt you, which could harm you, I can be trusted to turn those situations round so that those situations bring you good, not harm. Because I am who I am. I'm Yahweh Rofaka. I am Yahweh who heals you. I'll never change. And then this morning, we read from Exodus chapter 17, where we're going to find another of those compound names. Another of those names where Yahweh is linked with another word to bring out some feature of what God is to his people. The Israelites have travelled on a little further in the desert. And they camp now at a place called Rephidim. It's the Lord who tells them that they must camp there. They're led by the pillar of cloud by day, the pillar of fire by night. When that pillar comes to a halt, they know that they must camp in that place. So it's the Lord Yahweh who's brought them to this place, Rephidim. But there at Rephidim, once again, water becomes an issue. There's no water for them to drink at Rephidim. The Lord's brought them to this place, but he's not provided a water supply. And again, they begin to blame Moses. They begin to demand water from Moses. Give us water to drink. And Moses says, why quarrel with me? It's Yahweh who's brought you here. It's Yahweh you're challenging. And they just become more and more angry. They're ready to stone Moses in their fury because they are getting now desperately thirsty. It hasn't taken them long, has it, to forget the lesson they're supposed to have learned. Already they've forgotten how wonderfully Yahweh provided water for them at Marah. Didn't he promise then, I will never change? What I've done for you here, I'll always do for you. If you trust me, if you obey me. My name is Yahweh, isn't that what he said? I am who I am. I'm Yahweh who heals you. Well, they've already forgotten that. They think that the God who rescued them when they were desperate for water just a few weeks back has now abandoned them. They've forgotten that he's Yahweh, the unchanging God, Yahweh who heals them. But I think there's something more basic that's the problem here. Look at what they say in chapter 17, verse 3. They say to Moses, why did you bring us up out of Egypt to make us and our children and livestock die of thirst? Now, do you see what they're saying, what they're implying, what they're thinking? They're saying, if we were still in Egypt, we wouldn't ever be in this situation. We'd never have to go thirsty if we were in Egypt. In Egypt, there's always water. It's only because we're here in the desert that we're short of water. They thought of water, a water supply, as something that was just always there in Egypt. Something you could always depend on back there. They've got that mindset. They think of the water that flows through Egypt as something that just happens naturally, automatically, inevitably. There's this great big river, the Nile, which is always there in Egypt, which just flows of its own accord. So that everywhere in Egypt, you're guaranteed water. We're like that, aren't we? Whenever there's something, anything, that God provides regularly, constantly, our natural mindset is to think, to slide into the assumption that it just happens automatically. It happens inevitably. We turn on our taps and water flows out of them. It just happens automatically, doesn't it? We take it for granted. Water comes out of taps. We go down to Morrison's and the aisles are stacked with food. It just happens automatically, inevitably, doesn't it? The sun rises every morning. It's just a rule of nature, isn't it? That the sun rises every morning and we have heat and light. It happens automatically, it happens inevitably. My heart beats. Just happens automatically, doesn't it? Inevitably. How many people, even Christians, here in the UK, think of the water that flows through the taps as something that God supplies, that God keeps flowing? How many of us ever thank God for keeping it flowing one more day? How many of us pray that he'll carry on doing so? How many of you this morning, when you went to turn on the tap in the kitchen to make your cup of tea, prayed that there would be water? How many of us really pray, give us this day our daily bread? We don't, because we just take it for granted. It comes to us automatically, inevitably. It's natural, it's inevitable that Morrison's shelves should have everything on that we need. How many of us are really conscious that the only reason another day has dawned is that God has kept the earth revolving? How many of us are aware that it's God who's kept our hearts beating through the night? Just like the Israelites. They look back on their days in Egypt. Ah, back then water just flowed naturally, inevitably, automatically. Whereas now God has brought them into a place where unless he intervenes, unless he supplies water directly, there isn't going to be any. And they don't like being in a place like that. A place where they're obviously dependent on God day by day. They panic when they're in a situation like that. They're not used to it. But isn't that exactly why God has brought them into this desert? To teach them that water doesn't come automatically by some natural, inevitable law. When they were in Egypt, they were conditioned to think that way. But now God has brought them into the desert so that they can learn to live conscious that everything they've got, even the most basic necessities, come only because God sends them. And if God withdraws them, those necessities are not going to be there. That's what God does for us if we're his children. We've got this horrible inbuilt tendency to take all God's blessings for granted. Just to assume that those blessings are there by some automatic law of life. I call it a horrible tendency. It is. It's unthinking. It's ungrateful. It's self-absorbed. You know, we hate it when we see that tendency in our own children, don't we? You know, mum slaves away looking after the home, putting meals on the table, putting clean clothes in the drawer. How often do the children think about it? They just take it all for granted. It's just a law of nature, isn't it? That there's always an ironed shirt in the drawer. When teenage son wants to go out in the evening. Just happens automatically. And we say, oh, he's got no idea what his mum does for him. And maybe one day we say, that lad needs to be taught a lesson. needs to be taught that that shirts don't just iron themselves. And so the day comes when this lad has got this really important event, well, from his point of view. And shock, horror, there's no clean shirt, no ironed shirt in the drawer. Because, you know, shirts don't just wash themselves. They don't just iron themselves by some automatic process. And mum and dad have decided that it's time son learned that. So on this day, when it's so important for him, mum just hasn't done the ironing. Well, God teaches us in the same way. There are times when something we've always taken for granted, the Lord takes it away from us. So that we're in the situation where we actually start realizing that it's only by His kindness that we ever had it at all. And we realize that unless He decides to supply it now, we're never going to have it again. That applies to all sorts of things, doesn't it? Maybe one of the reasons why the Lord is plunging Europe and the UK into recession. So that His children at last will realize that employment, jobs for all, salary, social security handouts, health care, aren't just guaranteed, inevitable things that we can take for granted. Maybe that it's only when the electricity and gas get cut off. And after all, we've been buying them in from other countries. There's going to come a point where we can't afford to do that. It's only when there's no petrol in the petrol stations. It's only when there's no food in the stores. Maybe it'll only be then that Christians will really start praying, give us this day our daily bread. Applies to health, doesn't it? Yeah, we think of our heart as something that just beats automatically until we have a heart attack, until we survive a heart attack. And then maybe we start to be aware that each day we live is by God's kindness alone. It applies in the life of a church in so many ways. Maybe a church has just seen week after week, month after month, year after year, conversions. Just take it for granted. Providing that we keep up the proper routines of church life. Providing that we carry on our evangelistic activities. Well, conversions just happen, don't they? And so then the Lord sends famine. Months go by, years go by, maybe decades go by, and there are no conversions. Because conversions don't happen automatically. They only happen if the Lord chooses to save people. Maybe a church for many years has had a pastor. And that pastor preaches regularly, carefully, helpfully. And the members just take it for granted. Providing you have the right man, providing you hire the right man, you can always guarantee solid, useful ministry. And so they don't pray that God will feed them from His word. Because it happens automatically. That becomes their unconscious mindset. Until the Lord takes their pastor away. And then they struggle to find anyone who can take his place. Anyone who's willing to come and preach to them. And they start realizing that unless God provides, they're going to face a famine of hearing the word of God. God does it in so many different ways. He does it in all the different areas of our lives. He brings us into the desert. Not to torment us, but because He wants us to learn that every blessing, including the blessings that seem most common and most constant, are only there because He sends them. And if He withdraws them, they're not going to be there any longer. These Israelites were always going to take water for granted until they were in a desert where there was no ready water supply. Now let's see how the Lord drives this lesson home to the Israelites. What does the Lord tell Moses to do? Verse 5, the Lord answered Moses, walk on ahead of the people. Take with you some of the elders of Israel and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile and go. Why has Moses got to take the staff? The staff with which he struck the Nile in Egypt. What were the Israelites supposed to think about when they saw Moses holding that staff in his hand? Well, they're supposed to remember what happened when he struck the Nile in Egypt. What did happen? The Nile turned to blood. Remember? In fact, all the water supplies of Egypt turned to blood. It became undrinkable. The Israelites are saying, oh, back in Egypt, water was guaranteed. And the Lord is saying to them, have you forgotten? Have you forgotten how Egypt nearly died of thirst? Water was no more guaranteed in Egypt than it was here in the desert. The Lord saying, I could cut off the drinking supply of Egypt any time I wanted. I did when Moses lifted up that staff. Do you remember? The Israelites' memories were very selective, weren't they? Oh, back in Egypt there was always water. Why couldn't we have stayed there? And it's not true. Even in Egypt, God made it clear that there would only be water if he allowed it. There was that day in Egypt when God cut off the water supply. And this was the staff he used to do it. And now, he's going to use the same staff to give water here in the thirsty desert. Verse 6. The Lord says to Moses, I will stand there before you by the rock at Horeb. Strike the rock with the staff in your hand, and water will come out of it for the people to drink. The same staff which cut off the water supply of Egypt is now going to provide water in the middle of the desert. Water, the most common of blessings. The Israelites had always taken it for granted. And yet now they've got to learn that it's turned off by the Lord's command. It's turned on at the Lord's command. The staff can be used equally by the Lord to turn the water off or to turn the water on. There's nothing automatic about water supplies. There's nothing automatic about any of the blessings we take for granted. We really are dependent on God for everything, every moment. Well, the Israelites are learning. They're learning slowly. They stay for a while at Rephidim, drinking the water that flows from that rock. Water that so obviously God has provided. Every mouthful of water that they drink is something for which surely they've got to give God thanks now. It's a miracle. Every cup of water they give, once it would have been taken for granted, now they know it's miraculous. It's flowing out of that rock where there was no water supply before. They're learning their lesson. But the Lord hasn't finished hammering home this lesson that he's teaching them. While they're there, camping at Rephidim, maybe while they're recovering from dehydration, the Lord allows them to be attacked, to be assaulted in a new way. We read in chapter 17, verse 8, the Amalekites came and attacked the Israelites there at Rephidim. Now, who were the Amalekites? answer. They were a small desert tribe, a nomadic tribe, descended from Esau. Not one of the great tribes, only a small nation, probably no more than a few thousand fighting men, while the Israelites had become a vast nation, hundreds of thousands of fighting men. In the normal course of events, you would expect the Israelites to have no problem dealing with a force the size of Amalek. But this wasn't normal. The Amalekites didn't fight fair. They were desert guerrillas. That's guerrillas, G-U, not G-O. They were a guerrilla fighting force. You can read about their fighting techniques in Deuteronomy 25, where Moses reminds the Israelites, remember what Amalek did to you along the way when you came out of Egypt. When you were weary and worn out, they met you on your journey, and they cut off all who were lagging behind. They had no fear of God. That's the way Amalek fought. Rapidly moving fighting force, mounting guerrilla raids, avoiding pitched battles, cutting off stragglers, striking when the Israelites were tired out or dehydrated, hitting vulnerable points around the camp. That's what the Israelites were up against. And that meant that all their advantage in numbers counted for nothing. An enemy that just suddenly comes out of the darkness, that attacks an outpost, and then vanishes again into the darkness. A force that knows the desert like the back of its hand, that knows how to make use of the rocks, the hiding places. How can the Israelites deal with that? The answer is they were helpless under those conditions. Oh, I'm sure the Israelites would have thought of themselves as a great fighting force. If you'd asked them before Rephidim, how would you deal with an enemy a few thousand strong? They'd have laughed. They'd have said, an enemy a few thousand strong, we'd walk all over them. They'd have no chance against us. We'd just crush them by weight of numbers. We've got hundreds of thousands of troops. It's automatic, isn't it? It's inevitable. Victory's guaranteed in those circumstances. But no, once again, God has brought them into a situation where they're helpless. Just as there was no automatic water supply, so there was no automatic safety from Amalek. Moses knows now that no human strategy, no human resource, no human courage, no brilliant generalship is going to help now against this sort of army that he's facing. Unless God intervenes, unless God helps, they cannot win this war. Moses says to Joshua, choose some of our men and go out to fight the Amalekites. No point in trying to marshal the whole army of Israel. Just choose a fighting force. Numbers aren't going to make any difference now. The question is, will God help? For the Israelites to win this war of attrition, somehow they're going to have to locate the main Amalekite fighting force. They're going to have to trap them somewhere where the Amalekites will be forced to fight. They're going to have to overcome all the handicaps of the desert terrain. It's not going to be a battle won by a single great charge, by half an hour of overwhelming power. It's going to be a long, drawn-out struggle. And at every point in that struggle, the Israelites are going to be utterly dependent on God's help. Moses knows what he has to do. Tomorrow, he says to Joshua, while you're going out against the enemy, I'm going to stand at the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hands. The same staff that God used to cut off the water supply of Egypt. The same staff that God used to give us water here in the desert. I'm going to hold out that staff. And I'm going to beg God to use it now to defeat the enemy. That staff had become the sign of God's power. It had become the sign of God's power to curse and of God's power to bless. God's power to punish, God's power to save. Well, now Moses says, I'm going to lift that staff up to God. I'm going to beg him to use his power to punish Amalek and to save us from this enemy against whom we're helpless. And so we read, verse 10, Joshua fought the Amalekites as Moses had ordered. And Moses, Aaron, his brother, the high priest, Hur, who was the leader of the tribe of Judah, they went to the top of the hill. And as long as Moses held up his hands, with that staff in his hands, the Israelites were winning. But whenever he lowered his hands, the Amalekites were winning. And when Moses' hands grew tired, well, the other two took a stone and put it under him. He sat on it. And Aaron and Hur held his hands up, one on each side. One on one side, one on the other. So that Moses' hands remained steady till sunset. All through that day, right till sunset, Moses' hands holding that staff lifted up in appeal to God. So Joshua overcame the Amalekite army with the sword. All day, Moses is there, holding up that staff towards God, to the God who sits enthroned in heaven, the God who's in control of everything, the God from whom all blessings, all help, every good thing comes. And when Moses gets too tired to hold his hands up any longer, he mustn't let them droop. Others must hold them up for him. And meanwhile, Joshua and his chosen force, they carry on the long struggle against the elusive enemy below. That enemy didn't give up quickly, did he? Battle went on all through the day. I guess there must have been times when Joshua wished that it was Moses who was in command of the fighting force. Moses, much more experienced general than young Joshua. Moses, the great inspirational figurehead. But Moses, no, he mustn't lead Israel in this battle. Because if Moses were leading Israel in this battle, what would the Israelites be thinking? Ah, yes, when Moses leads us, we're guaranteed victory. It would just become another automatic process, wouldn't it? Great general, automatic victory. Now, Moses' role today is simply to keep appealing to God. If the Israelites are going to win, it's going to be because God has intervened. It's going to be because God has supplied their need. All through the hours of the battle, at every point, in every skirmish, it's God who's given them victory. You think of the Israelites in the camp. They can see Moses silhouetted up there on the skyline. He's not leading the army. Up there, they can see him, his hands lifted in silent appeal to God. God wants the Israelites to carry that picture in their mind for the rest of their lives. The lesson it teaches, battles are won not by some automatic process, not by superiority of numbers, not by having a great general. Battles are won by the God of heaven who gives strength to his people. No other hope except in him. Joshua overcame the Amalekite army with the sword. But it was the Lord. It was the Lord who empowered the Israelites. It was the Lord who made that victory possible. Then the Lord said to Moses, write this on a scroll as something to be remembered. And make sure that Joshua hears it. Because I will completely erase the memory of the Amalekites from under heaven. See, the Israelites won an overwhelming victory that day over Amalek. But it wasn't a final victory. That's why it's in the future tense, I will completely erase. For many years to come, the Amalekites were still going to be there. And they were going to continue to be a relentless, cruel enemy. They were going to carry on harassing the Israelites when they had opportunity. They were going to threaten them. They were going to strike at them in unexpected, cruel ways. Some of you know the book of Esther. Someday just look it up and see who Haman was descended from. Joshua was going to have to fight against the Amalekites many more times in the future. Long after Moses was no longer there on the scene. And always Joshua's got to remember this day. He's got to remember that victory came for one reason alone. Because the Lord gave victory. Joshua and the Israelites must never slide into the mindset that says, some blessings come automatically. Whether it's the water we need to drink, whether it's safety from the attacks of the enemy, the Israelites had to remember, it was written there in the book, we depend upon God only. We depend upon God always. Jesus taught his disciples to pray, our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be your name, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. Forgive us our trespasses, our sins, as we forgive those who sin against us. Lead us not into trial. Deliver us from the evil one. Jesus taught his disciples that for everything they were dependent upon God. That they were to be asking and knocking and seeking, not just for the great things, the hallowing of God's name, the extending of God's kingdom, but for daily bread, for freedom from daily trials, for victory in all those attacks of the evil one. Nothing guaranteed, nothing happening automatically. A constant daily calling upon God. That was the lesson that the Israelites were supposed to be learning. That's why the record of this battle was to be written down in this memorial book. But that wasn't the only memorial of this occasion. We read this in verse 15. Moses built an altar there in that desert place. Monument was set up. An altar, no doubt, they offered sacrifices of thanksgiving on that altar. But that altar was also there to be a monument. During these next 40 years, as they wandered around the wilderness, I wonder how many more times they came back to that spot and saw that altar standing there, perhaps on the very place where they'd seen Moses sitting with his hands stretched up to heaven. And Moses gave that altar a name. He called it, "The Lord is my banner." Yahweh Nisi. Every time they came back to that spot, every time they looked at that monument, they would say, "Yahweh is my banner." When we think of a banner, I suppose we think of a big flag fluttering in the breeze. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about the standards that men carried into battle. Every army would carry its standards, and they usually wouldn't be flags. They'd be some sort of strong metal signs. The Assyrians carried battle standards on their chariots. We've got carvings depicting the Assyrian battle standards. Their god Ashur is there standing between two bulls, and that standard is attached to a chariot. They go into battle under that battle standard. The Romans went into battle, and each legion had its eagle. And each eagle was a little representation of the power of Rome. And the troops sacrificed to their eagles, to their battle standards. The nations worshipped their battle standards. They were mobile idols. That's why they carried them into battle with them, because those guaranteed them success. The Israelites were going to carry no standards into battle with them. The whole reason why the heathen carried their banners, their standards with them, is because their gods were idols. Gods that you could force to do what you wanted them to do. If you only carry the right standard with the right idol on the top, you're guaranteed victory. Moses says, hands were lifted up to the throne of the Lord. Our God is in heaven. He does as he pleases. We can't make him come into battle with us. And yet he is the battle standard under which we fight. In him alone is our hope. And that's why we hold out our hands to him and we beg him to go into battle with us. We beg him to give us our help. The Lord is our hope, our standard, our banner, says Moses. And all we can do is stretch out our hands and say, "Oh, give us your help. Give it freely, out of your love, out of your grace, because you are Yahweh." Again, it comes down to that, isn't it? Yahweh is my banner, says Moses. That's the standard under which I fight. That's where all my hope is, in the fact that he is who he is, unchangingly faithful, compassionate towards his people, determined to save them. Yahweh, the unchanging God, the battle standard under which we live, under which we fight all our battles against Satan. Hands were lifted up to the throne of the Lord. What a picture it is. Moses with his hands stretched up to the God above. Aren't we glad that the Lord Jesus in heaven has his hands stretched upwards as he prays for us. Aren't we glad that his hands never grow weary, never grow weak, that he's always saying, Father, Father, be merciful to my people. Give them victory every day. Give them strength. That's why in the end all of our victories will be won. That's why in the end we will, if we are Christ's, come safely through all the conflicts of this world and come to the new heavens and the new earth. That's why all the elect will be saved. That's why all Satan's plans will be defeated. That's why all the stragglers, and our hearts go out to them, don't they? Don't we? That's why all the stragglers will come safely through. Because Christ has prayed, but we join him in our praying. Where does our help come from? Our help comes from the Lord our God. From the Lord who is our banner. There's no other banner, no other standard that we can carry into battle that guarantees us victory. All we can do is raise our hands to our God, our Father, Yahweh Nissi, the Lord, our banner, our hope is in him.